and we are going to be in the book of Zechariah again this morning. We've got a lot of work to do today, so there's going to be no real recap of last week or where we've been, because we want to look at chapters 10 and 11 together. The reason we want to look at two chapters together is that chapters 10 and 11, thematically, if you want to call it that, they belong together. As I was studying and reading chapters 10 and 11, I'm like, there's just no good place to press pause, and we'll come back to it next week. We just need to do this whole chunk together. And so I need to warn you ahead of time, these chapters are quite dark. I laughed this week because, you know, Mother's Day, we were in the vision of the woman in the basket. And then Father's Day, it's like these dark two chapters. But hey, that's what you get when we just preach through books of the Bible. We don't plan these things ahead of time. So the reason these two chapters are quite dark is in them we see God furious with the leaders of his people. We see God promise to send a leader, send a shepherd to his own people. We see the people of God reject this leader and ultimately choose to continue to follow evil leaders. And because of that, God says that he will punish his own people severely. So it is a heavy passage, but like most of the heavy passages that we've looked at in the minor prophets, there are still glimmers of hope and redemption in them. So that being said, I want to read chapters 10 and 11 together. I know it'll be a bit of a longer reading, but I think it's just necessary to hear the flow of these two chapters, and then we want to walk through it together and just try and understand it and apply it. So, Zechariah chapter 10, starting in verse 1. Ask rain from the Lord in the season of the spring rain, from the Lord who makes the storm clouds, and he will give them showers of rain to everyone, the vegetation in the field. For the household gods utter nonsense, and the diviners see lies. They tell false dreams and give empty consolation. Therefore, the people wander like sheep. They are afflicted for lack of a shepherd. My anger is hot against the shepherds, and I will punish the leaders. For the Lord of hosts cares for his flock, the house of Judah, and will make them like his majestic steed in battle. From him shall come the cornerstone, from him the tent peg, from him the battle bow, from him every ruler, all of them together. They shall be like mighty men in battle, trampling the foe in the mud of the streets. They shall fight because the Lord is with them. They shall put to shame the riders on horses. I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph. I will bring them back because I have compassion on them. And they shall be as though I had not rejected them, for I am the Lord their God, and I will answer them. Then Ephraim shall become like a mighty warrior, and their hearts shall be glad as with wine. Their children shall see it and be glad. Their hearts shall rejoice in the Lord. I will whistle for them and gather them in, for I have redeemed them. And they shall be as many as they were before. Though I scattered them among the nations, yet in far countries they shall remember me. And with their children they shall live and return. I will bring them home from the land of Egypt and gather them from Assyria. I will bring them to the land of Gilead and to Lebanon till there is no room for them. He shall pass through the sea of troubles and strike down the waves of the sea, and all the depths of the Nile shall be dried up. The pride of Assyria shall be laid low, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart. I will make them strong in the Lord, and they shall walk in his name, declares the Lord. Open your doors, O Lebanon, that the fire may devour your cedars. Wail, O Cyprus, for the cedar has fallen, for the glorious trees are ruined. Wail, oaks of Bashan, for the thick forest has been felled. The sound of the wail of the shepherds for their glory is ruined. The sound of the roar of the lions for the thicket of the Jordan is ruined. Thus said the Lord my God, become shepherd of the flock doomed to slaughter. Those who buy them slaughter them and go unpunished, and those who sell them say, blessed be the Lord, I've become rich. And their own shepherds have no pity on them. For I will no longer have pity on the inhabitants of this land, declares the Lord. Behold, I will cause each of them to fall into the hand of his neighbor, and each into the hand of his king, and they shall crush the land, and I will deliver none from their hand. So I became the shepherd of the flock doomed to be slaughtered by the sheep traders. And I took two staffs, one I named Favor, The other I named Union, and I tended the sheep. In 1 month I destroyed the three shepherds, but I became impatient with them, and they also detested me. So I said, I will not be your shepherd. What is to die, let it die. What is to be destroyed, let it be destroyed. And let those who are left devour the flesh of one another. And I took my staff favor and I broke it, annulling the covenant that I had made with all the peoples. So it was annulled on that day. And the sheep traders who were watching me knew that it was the word of the Lord. Then I said to them, if it seems good to you, give me my wages, but if not, keep them. And they weighed out as my wages 30 pieces of silver. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, the lordly price at which I was priced by them. So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them into the house of the Lord to the potter. Then I broke my second staff, Union, annulling the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. Then the Lord said to me, take once more the equipment of a foolish shepherd. For behold, I am raising up in the land a shepherd who does not care for those being destroyed, or seek the young, or heal the maimed, or nourish the healthy, but devours the flesh of the fat ones, tearing off even their hoofs. Woe to my worthless shepherd who deserts the flock. May the sword strike his arm and his right eye. Let his arm be wholly withered, his right eye utterly blinded. The reading of God's word. So, like, needless to say, this is a heavy two chapters of Scripture, and I'm sure that Lot's was like, okay, what exactly is going on in chapters 10 and 11? And we're going to get to the fulfillment of these two chapters in the person and work of Jesus, and I'm sure that some of you have already maybe connected some of the dots going, okay, I get what Zechariah is talking about. But we want to start back in chapter 10. Chapter 10, up until the third verse of chapter 11, deals with God's anger at the shepherds of the people and his promise to send them a good shepherd. So verses 1 to 3, God is basically laying out the problem that was going on in Israel. He starts in verse 1 by telling them to ask for rain from the Lord, because it's God who makes the storm clouds and he gives showers of rain to everyone. Most likely, this is probably a rebuke of Baal worship, because if you know anything about the false worship of Baal, Baal was often seen as, well, maybe Baal's the God who makes storm clouds and Baal is the one who controls the rain. But God is saying, no, ask me for rain. I'm the one who sends the rain. And he even continues in verse 2, the household gods utter nonsense, and the diviners tell lies, they tell false dreams, and they give empty consolation. So people obviously were turning to idol worship and divination in order to get answers for things. And household gods would be, you know, each family would carve an image out of wood or metal or something like that, and that would be, that's our God who protects this household. And all that did, we're told, is it just left the people empty. Why? Well, the household gods utter nonsense. They actually can't give you any good advice. It's a piece of wood. It's metal. It's nothing, essentially. And the diviners, those who read omens or speak on behalf of dead people, God says, well, they actually see lies. They're liars. They're not telling you anything of use. And so what's going on is the people of Israel were clearly once again worshiping false gods, doing things that the law of God forbid. And what was the result of that? We're told at the end of verse 2, therefore the people wander like sheep, they're afflicted for lack of a shepherd. So essentially the picture is people wandering around helpless and afflicted because they had no shepherd. They had no one that would lead them. And really, if you remember, this is exactly what Jesus said as he looked over the crowds. Mark 6:34, when he, Jesus, went ashore, he saw a great crowd and he had compassion on them. Why? Because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So people wandering around with no aim, no direction, worshiping false gods, like sheep wandering around without a shepherd. Now, the reality is the people did have shepherds. They were just terrible. Verse 3, God says, my anger is hot against the shepherds, and I will punish the leaders, for the Lord cares for his flock and will make them like his majestic steed in battle. So there were shepherds in Zechariah's day. There were shepherds in Jesus' day. There were leaders, shepherds of God's people, but they were useless. And God was angry with them. When it says, I will punish the leaders in verse 3, the word leaders is the Hebrew word for male goats. So on one hand, God is insulting the shepherds of the day, but male goats was often used as an image of abusive power. And one of the commentaries I read said, you know, when shepherds or people who owned goats would open the pen, male goats butt to the front of the group because they want to be the first ones out. So like chivalry is dead among goats, right? No, they're not like, here, ladies, you go first. There, male goats, it's a picture of, they don't care about anybody else. Male goats want to be the first one out of the pen. And so, yes, it's an insult, but actually it's quite an apt picture of leaders who care about nobody else except themselves. They would abuse the people in order to gain from them. So for sake of time, we're not going to read it, but Ezekiel 34, that entire chapter, you should read it. It's a rebuke in similar language against the shepherds of Israel. So then God says, well, the shepherds of Israel, my anger is hot against them. I will care for my own flock, and I will send a shepherd. Because verse 4 says, from him shall come. Well, from who? Well, Judah is mentioned in chapter 3, which we know from the tribe of Judah, the Messiah came. But also God, it's coming from him, his Messiah. From him shall come. And then these four descriptive words are used. The cornerstone, the tent peg, the battle bow. From him, every ruler, all of them together. And so these four descriptions are descriptions of the Messiah, this leader that God was going to send. The cornerstone is the thing that, you know, the entire building is built off of. And that phrase was used in other places in the Old Testament. Psalm 118, 22, the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Even Jesus quotes that in Matthew 21 when he's talking about himself. Isaiah 28, 16, behold, I am the one who has laid as a foundation in Zion, a stone, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone of a sure foundation. So this is the Messiah. From Judah will come the tent peg, which is an interesting image. But simply put, it represents support and stability, the one on whom the weight of the nation rests. From Judah will come the battle bow, that's a picture representing military power, strength, and might. And lastly, from Judah will come every ruler, all of them together. If you remember in Micah 5, 2, it spoke about this ruler as well. From you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient days. So the picture that we have is this Messiah, a shepherd, a ruler who's going to come and lead the people. But not only that, not only is this Messiah going to lead them, but he's going to transform them from wandering sheep into his majestic steed in battle, into a war horse. So then verses 6 to 11 summarize what this Messiah is going to do as he gathers his people in. So for sake of time, we want to just kind of fly over this section, but I want you to notice the wording that is used. These are all things that God himself is going to do. So verse 6, he says, I will strengthen the house of Judah. Notice that it doesn't say Judah is going to strengthen itself. No. God says, I will strengthen the house of Judah. I will save the house of Joseph. I will bring them back. I have compassion on them. They shall be as though I had not rejected them. Verse 8, God says, I will whistle for them and gather them in, like a shepherd, right, who whistles for his sheep. I will bring them in. I've redeemed them. Verse 10, God says, I will bring them home from Egypt and gather them from Assyria. So he's using, right, just ancient enemies of God's people. No, I'm going to bring them back. I'm going to bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon. And he says, I'm going to bring them in until there's no room for them. So if you remember, even in the vision earlier of the man with the measuring line, that was a picture of a city that had no walls because there were so many people there. So again, that theme is repeated, God bringing his people in until there's no more room for them. So like over and over and over in these verses, it's these promises of God restoring his people, redeeming them, saving them. And verse 12 really is the summary of this whole section. He says, I will make them strong in the Lord, and they shall walk in his name. So no longer are the people going to be wandering around helpless like sheep without a shepherd. No, God's going to whistle for them, bring them in. They're going to be strong, and they're going to walk in his name. So really, chapter 10 is this picture of God replacing wicked shepherds with his own leader, the Messiah, and bringing them in. Now, chapter 11, verse 1, then flips a bit back to the condemnation of the leaders of the day. And if you've studied the minor prophets with us, you'll know that oftentimes passages, they kind of flip back and forth between condemnation and then redemption and promises and back and forth. And it's no different here. Verses 1 to 3 essentially describes calamity. And it's done using imagery of forests and the woods and nature just being completely wiped out. It says, "Open your doors, O Lebanon, that the fire may devour your cedars." And if you know biblically, Lebanon was famous for its cedar trees, and it's this picture of fire just devouring all of them. "Wail, O Cyprus, for the cedar has fallen. The glorious trees are ruined. Wail, oaks of Bashan, for the thick forest has been felled." All the trees cut down, essentially. "The sound of the wail of the shepherds, for their glory is ruined. The roar of lions, because the Jordan is ruined. So basically, it's just a picture of destruction, a wasteland. Now, here's what's important to remember. Verses 1 to 3 is a description of calamity. And now, verses 4 to 17 is the reason why this calamity is coming. Now, we've seen before when Zechariah was asked by God to perform a sign act, to do something that would symbolize or act out the message that God wanted to give his people. Like we've talked about this, sometimes the prophets were asked by God, "Hey, I want you to do these physical things as a way to convey the message," right? We talked about Jeremiah. God said, "I want you to dig a hole in the wall of your house, pack a bag, go through the hole in your wall and cover your eyes." And that's going to be a symbol of the exile and how people are going to be led away blind and things like that. So Jeremiah literally acted this thing out. So even in chapter 6 of Zechariah, God asked Zechariah, "I want you to take Joshua, I want you to make a crown, and I want you to crown him as this priest king that was to come." So now here we have in the rest of chapter 11, God asks Zechariah to do something that's going to convey a message to the people. So verses 4 to 6 describe what the prophet is supposed to do and why. It says, "Thus said the Lord my God." So Zechariah is saying, "This is what God asked me to do. Become shepherd of the flock doomed to slaughter." So God asks Zechariah to act out being the shepherd of the flock of Israel, meaning I want you to portray this coming shepherd, the Messiah that chapter 10 talked about. I want you to portray the shepherd of the flock doomed to slaughter. Now, we're not told what exactly this looked like. We're told that he took two staffs, and we'll get to that later. But we're not told, and I would love to know, what did Zechariah do? Did he walk around and pretend to shepherd, you know, the sheep? What did he say? What did he wear? Like, all those details, we're not really given that. We're just told about his two staffs later on. But he's meant to act this out. I want you to portray this coming shepherd. Verse 5, it says, "Those who buy them slaughter them and go unpunished, and those who sell them say, 'Blessed be the Lord, I've become rich,' and their own shepherds have no pity on them." So here's the condition of the day. I would say the rest of chapter 11, because Zechariah is meant to act out this Messiah shepherd, chapter 11 is describing the spiritual condition of the time at Jesus' ministry. Israel's own shepherds, the leaders of the day, the Pharisees, the priests, other leaders, they had no pity on them. So the shepherds of Israel did not care about the people. And the picture is people selling humans into slavery, devouring them. And then in a twist, just this perversion, it says, and then they thank God for blessing them with wealth from the sale. Like, think about how perverted that is. People doing these terribly unjust things. I'm going to go and sell my neighbors into slavery. And then when I get paid from that, I'm going to go, wow, thank you, Lord, for blessing me with this financial kickback from my evil and wickedness. Like, that is twisted thinking. But that's what was going on. You had leaders taking advantage of people. You had other people taking advantage of others and then thanking God that he was blessing them in that. So verse 6, God says, "For I will no longer have pity on the inhabitants of the land, declares the Lord. Behold, I will cause each of them to fall into the hand of his neighbor and each into the hand of his king, and they shall crush the land and I will deliver none from their hand." So here's a picture of God saying, I'm not going to have pity on you anymore. I'm actually going to give you over into the hands of each other, into the hands of your king. I'm not going to deliver you. Now, the reason God's doing this and he's almost taking his hands off and giving them over to their own sin, we're going to get to. The reason is because the people's rejection of the Messiah, the shepherd, which the rest of the passage lays out in great detail. But just think even of the historical timeline here and how patient and merciful God has been with his people. For hundreds of years, he warned them and sent messenger after messenger after messenger. God sent prophet after prophet after prophet. I mean, we've studied 11 of them now, prophet after prophet, telling the people, repent, turn back to God, stop going down this path before it's too late. And we've seen over and over, what did the people do? They ignored him, ignored God. And so, rightly so, God sent his people into exile for 70 years in Babylon. But even there, God showed them mercy and grace, and they were released from exile, and they returned to Jerusalem, and they begin to rebuild the temple, but they fall right back into the same exact sins, right? Household gods, diviners, selling people, slavery, all of these things, just terrible things. And God warns them again. He warns them and he warns them and he warns them. And eventually God sends his own son, the Messiah, a good shepherd, to lead them. And what do the people do? They kill him. So God is saying in this passage, well, then I'm no longer going to have pity on you. Your hearts are too hard. I have shown mercy for hundreds and hundreds of years, and I've warned you, and I've warned you, and I've warned you. I sent my own son, and you killed him. I'm not having pity anymore. Now, most scholars believe that this punishment that God is talking about took place in 70 AD when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem and destroyed the temple, and just awful things took place during that time. People turning on each other, the king turning on people, the land being crushed, very much what is described here. And it's this idea that God actually just gave them over to their own sinfulness. You even see that idea in the New Testament in Romans chapter 1. It says that people didn't want to worship God, and so God gave them over to what they wanted. So in Romans 1, the progression is people, I don't want to worship God, I want to worship other things. And God said, okay, fine, I'm going to allow you to go and do that. And what does it lead to? Death. So here we're seeing this picture of God's patience running out. The people so far gone that even when a good shepherd came to them, they rejected him and killed him. And so verses 4-6, God asks Zechariah, I want you to become the shepherd of the flock. Act this out in whatever way that looked. And so verse 7 then is Zechariah's response to what God is asking him to do. He says in verse 7, so I became the shepherd of the flock, doomed to be slaughtered by the sheep traders. So what's interesting here is, there's some discrepancy about how we translate the original Hebrew of this verse, specifically the phrase, the sheep traders, right? In verse 7, so I became the shepherd of the flock doomed to be slaughtered by the sheep traders. And there are some manuscripts that we have that say, I became the shepherd of the flock doomed to be slaughtered, particularly the oppressed of the flock. And so you go, well, wait a second, what's the difference here? And hear me out. Both translations work, right? It could be sheep traders, or it could be the oppressed of the flock. And it has to do with how certain Hebrew words are translated and divided when it comes to the the text, but it also necessitates removing certain vowels and things like that. But I actually think it makes much more sense, especially later on in verse 11, which we'll get to, that Zechariah is called to act out this role of shepherd of the flock doomed to slaughter, especially those of the flock who are needy and miserable and oppressed. So what that tells us is that there's some in the flock who are being taken advantage of, who are oppressed, who are needy. And so Zechariah is meant to become shepherd to the flock, especially the ones that are oppressed. So you continue on in verse 7, Zechariah takes two staffs and he names them. So here's this symbolic action. One he names favor and one he names union. And it says, and he tended the sheep. I would have loved to know what that looked like. The word favor means beauty or grace, and the word union brings up the idea of bands, or, you know, when binding two things together, like this tie. And so these two staffs are meant to represent God's gracious benefit towards his people, his favor, his grace towards them, his blessing, and the union of God's people together as a nation. So he has these two staffs, and they come into play later. In verse 8, Zechariah says, "In 1 month I destroyed the three shepherds." So you go, what does that mean? Right? Did Zechariah kill someone? Right? You go, what does that mean? Right? So you have to remember, Zechariah is, he's acting out what the Messiah came to do. And so there's debate. Okay, is it a literal month? How long was it? Who are these three shepherds? Because even you keep reading, it says, I became impatient with them. And they also detested me, so I said, I will not be your shepherd. What is to die, let it die. What is to be destroyed, let it be destroyed. And let those who are left devour the flesh of one another. So Zechariah is acting out this arrival and ministry of Jesus, the Messiah, and the people's response to the Messiah coming. So who are the three shepherds that he destroyed? And one commentator I read said there's 40 different theories. We're not going to go through all of them, but 40 different theories about, okay, who exactly are these three shepherds? Are they leaders of popular Jewish factions? Are these kings? Some have said, well, maybe these are the last three kings before the exile happened. Maybe that's what Zechariah is getting at. Are these the three different high priests? And on and on and on the theories go. I think rather than three specific individuals, God is speaking of the three classes of leaders that existed throughout the history of Israel. Who were they? Prophet, priest, and king. Those were the three positions of authority that God made for his nation. And we know throughout history that each one of them were full, oftentimes, of wicked, sinful people. Different kings, you read the history of the kings, it's the majority of them did not love God and pursued wickedness. You think about the priests, and sometimes they pursued wickedness and sin and evil. You think about the prophets, and yes, we have good prophets, but there were also false prophets who tried to lead the people astray. So what God is saying is he's coming against those offices, those positions of prophet, priest, and king because of the corruption and wickedness that exists there. So the word destroy just means God is removing them and he's limiting these faithless shepherds. And when you think about the ministry of Jesus, Jesus abolished all of those offices. Or rather, he fulfilled them. There's no need for priests. We don't have priests anymore. We don't need priests. Why? Jesus is our great high priest. There's no need for prophets anymore. Right? Hebrews 1, long ago and in many ways, God spoke to us through the prophets, but now he's spoken to us through his son, Jesus. Jesus fulfilled that role. There's no need for kings. Jesus is the king. And so what Jesus did when he came is he essentially destroyed those shepherdly roles. Now here is what is just fascinating and hard to understand. Jesus, the good shepherd, comes, right? Finally, a good shepherd, and he eliminates those wicked roles that were full of bad shepherds. But in verse 8, it says, he became impatient with them, and they detested me. So Jesus became impatient with the people, and they detested him. So here's what is so heartbreaking about the people. Finally, a good shepherd comes, faithful and righteous, and they detest him. And that word is so strong. Literally, it means to loathe something to the point of nausea. So think about that. There's been times when I've been very mad, and I can say I've hated someone, but I've never hated someone so strongly that I wanted to throw up. And that's literally what this word means. That the people hated the good shepherd so much, they loathed him to the point of nausea. So think about that. You could understand loathing a bad leader, right? We all know scenarios like that where you go, man, that man or woman, that is a bad leader. And you could understand loathing a leader that takes advantage of other people and uses people for their own gain. You could get that to a certain degree. But why on earth would people despise and loathe a good shepherd? Like when the good shepherd arrives, it's almost like those who don't desire a consistent righteous reign, they'll just despise the shepherd's faithfulness and they'll actively oppose his leadership. And when you think about it, that is exactly what happened when Jesus came. John 1, verse 9, speaking of Jesus, the true light which enlightens everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world and the world was made through him. Yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. Jesus himself in John 3, verse 19 says, this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and the people loved darkness rather than the light, because their works were evil. So in spite of Jesus' ideal ministry as the good shepherd, the flock as a whole detests him, and he grows weary of them. And we're going to get to, not everybody, right? There's always been a remnant who loved Jesus and longed for the Messiah to come. So not everyone, but by and large, almost everyone. And so what we see is the shepherd saying, I'm not going to be your shepherd anymore. He's terminating his care of the sheep. And it's not pretty. Death, destruction, cannibalism. And all of these things are recorded as happening during the Roman siege of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. Josephus, the historian, records the awful things that took place during that time. Exactly what was said here. Death, destruction, cannibalism actually going on. So what is plain to see is, what is the consequence of rejecting the good shepherd? Well, ultimately, it's death. And so in verse 10, he continues, Zechariah then performs these symbolic actions. It says, I took my staff favor and I broke it, annulling the covenant that I had made with all the peoples. So it was annulled on that day, and the sheep traders who were watching me knew that it was the word of the Lord. So Zechariah breaks his staff that he had named favor, and he says, the covenant is annulled. Now, what covenant? Right? That's really important, because it says the covenant that I made with all the peoples, or another way to say that is the covenant that I made with all the nations. And we go, well, wait a second, what covenant did God make with all the nations? And there's a few hints, but in Hosea chapter 2, it talks about God holding back other nations from completely wiping out his people. Even think in Zechariah chapter 9, verse 8, when it says, I, God, encamps at his house in Jerusalem so that no one marches over them. And we learned last week that Alexander the Great did just that. Alexander the Great destroyed all of these other cities, but he got to Jerusalem and spared them, for really no reason except divine providence. And God also saved his people and held off Antiochus later on, and he held off Pompeii later on from destroying the Israelites. But now it seems like God is saying, I'm removing my security, I'm removing my restraint, which I had held in place to hold back these other nations and to protect you, my people. But he's essentially saying, no more. And we know that in 70 AD, that's exactly what happened. The Romans destroyed Jerusalem and many, many people died. But here is the hope. Because it says that as Zechariah broke his staff, the sheep traders knew that it was the word of the Lord. Remember, sheep traders, that can be translated the afflicted of the flock. So think about that. As Zechariah performs this prophetic act, the afflicted of the flock, those in the flock who were oppressed, they said, this is the word of the Lord. So even amongst wickedness and idolatry and rebellion, there was a faithful few, a remnant those who even in Zechariah's day knew, okay, this is God speaking. We had better listen. Now, verses 12 and 13 then are another sign act that have direct fulfillment in the person and work of Jesus. So Zechariah goes to them, the flock, and says, if it seems good to you, give me my wages. But if not, keep them, right? Zechariah has said, I'm not being the shepherd anymore. He's acting out what's going on. He says, now, if it seems good, pay me my wages for me being your shepherd. But if not, keep them. And so the people, what do? They weigh out 30 pieces of silver. 30 pieces of silver was the Old Testament price, recorded in Exodus 21:32, of a slave that had been gored to death by an ox. So to put that into perspective, if I had a slave, and let's say, you know, Cameron's ox got out and gored my slave to death, the cost that Cam would have to pay me, he owes me 30 pieces of silver. That's the cost to replace that slave that was gored. So the shepherd's value, the good, righteous, faithful shepherd's value to the entire nation didn't even surpass the worth to replace one slave to a single family. What it's meant to represent is this trifling attitude of the people towards the shepherd. And so Zechariah, I mean, you even see that in his response. He says in verse 13, throw it to the potter, the lordly price at which I was priced by them. He's using sarcasm. Wow, 30 pieces of silver, this lordly price that you have given me. And so Zechariah is instructed, throw it to the potter. And so he takes 30 pieces of silver, and he throws it into the house of the Lord, the temple. And if you know the story of the crucifixion of Jesus, 30 pieces of silver was the price that Judas received to betray Jesus to his death. And after Jesus was arrested, Judas, he's overcome with remorse. He throws the 30 pieces of silver in the temple, and they go and they collect it and they buy a potter's field with it. So this is what the people, the flock, thought Jesus was worth. A measly 30 pieces of silver. This shepherd, the Messiah, Jesus, represented righteous leadership for a nation that had no longing for faithful shepherding. They hated righteousness and they loved evil. And you know what? We prefer our bad leaders. And so lastly, Zechariah breaks the second staff called union, and it annuls the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. It was meant to symbolize this dissolving of national solidarity. And some of you might be wondering, well, wait, didn't that happen a long time ago, right? Didn't the nations or the northern and southern kingdoms split already? So why is it talking about now? I mean, there was always hope, right, that one day the nation is just going to be reunited. It's not going to be north and south kingdoms now. But basically, Zechariah breaks the staff of union and says that national solidarity is not going to happen. And what's fascinating historically is that one of the things that led to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, not the only thing, but one of the things, was actually infighting in the nation of Israel. So there wasn't solidarity. And then the passage ends with verses 15 to 17, and Zechariah being asked once more to play the role, but this time of a foolish shepherd. The people, the flock, they've rejected the good shepherd. They've annulled these covenants of favor and union. They've rejected and killed the Messiah. So Zechariah, God says, I want you to play the part of a foolish shepherd. Because God says he's raising up in the land a shepherd who doesn't care for the people, a shepherd who doesn't care for those being destroyed, doesn't seek the young, doesn't heal the maimed, doesn't even nourish the healthy. I mean, that's basically the job description of a shepherd, right? And the shepherd's not going to do any of it, but he's going to devour the flesh of the fat ones and tear off their hoofs. So I don't think that God is describing one particular individual. Some have said, oh, maybe this is the Antichrist that God's describing. Perhaps. But I don't think he's describing one particular individual. Rather, I think it represents every leader of God's people from Zechariah's day, from Jesus' day, to the present, who seek their own evil desires. It's as if God is saying, hey, I sent you the faithful shepherd, my own son, and you loathed him, and you rejected him, and you killed him. Fine, I'm going to give you what your sinful heart wants. You want bad shepherds? Terrible leaders who actually don't care about you? Who only use you for your selfish gain? Fine. Here they are. I mean, even Jesus talks about this in the Gospel of John. John 5, he says, "You search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life, and it's they that bear witness about me. Yet you refuse to come to me that you may have life. I do not receive glory from people, but I know that you do not have the love of God within you. I've come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If another comes in his own name, you will receive him." I mean, even think about the crucifixion of Jesus when Pilate brought Jesus out and said, "Hey, behold your king." What did the priests and the leaders of the day scream back? "We have no king but Caesar." Not even God. God's not our king. We have no king except Caesar. And so here we have God saying, "Fine. You want bad leaders? You're going to have them. This is what you want." So, I mean, needless to say, right, hopefully you're still with me, chapters 10 and 11, it's heartbreaking. And it is dark. And the progression is just unbelievable to see. God's angry with the bad leadership of his people. He's angry that the shepherds are abusing the people and leading them into sin and idolatry. And he is going to send a shepherd, the Messiah, Jesus, a great, faithful, righteous leader. And in an unbelievable turn of events, the people hate him. They loathe him. They reject him. They insult him. They trade him for 30 pieces of silver and they crucify him. And history tells us that God punished his own people for their rejection of his son. So chapter 11, I mean, it clearly demonstrates God's just furious anger with Judah. Time and time and time again, God would send them shepherds to administer justice and promote righteousness. And time and time and time again, his people rejected these shepherds and wanted to continue in sin. And so finally, it's as if God makes one more effort. "I'm going to send my own son. Surely the people will listen to the Son of God." And they kill him. Right? Doesn't that remind you of the parable that Jesus tells? Of the master, and he sends servants to warn the people, and then finally he sends his own son, and they kill him. But here is what is amazing. God uses the greatest act of injustice and evil in the world, the execution of the world's only truly innocent human, and that brings about the salvation of mankind. So even in the midst of evil and wickedness and rejection, God actually brings about good. He is sovereign even in this. I mean, Peter even talks about this on his sermon on the day of Pentecost, Acts 2:22. He says, "Men of Israel, hear these words." So there is a crowd of Jewish people. He says, "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know, this Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death, because it is not possible for him to be held by it." And then he ends later by saying, "Let all the house of Israel therefore know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus, whom you crucified." So again, this points to the mind-blowing sovereignty of God. God knew all of this. God knew that he would send his son. He knew the people's hard hearts. He knew that Jesus would be rejected and loathed and hated. He knew ultimately that men would conspire against him to have him killed. And that act of crucifixion and resurrection, that is our salvation. God taking evil and turning it for good. So a couple of things to wrestle with as we think about this passage. Because if you were to read just Zechariah chapter 10 and 11, it would seem that God just utterly gives up on his people. Annuls the covenant, leaves them to bad shepherds because they've rejected Jesus. Which is why we have to keep studying chapter 12 and 13 and 14. But even think about, how does chapter 11 square away with what God says in Leviticus 26:44? God said this to his people, "Yet for all that, when they're in the land of their enemies, I will not spurn them, neither will I abhor them, so as to destroy them utterly and break my covenant with them, for I am the Lord their God." So how do you reconcile these two things? In Leviticus, where God says, "I'm not going to destroy them completely, I'm not going to destroy them utterly. I'm not going to break my covenant with them. And then you get to Zechariah 11, and it seems like God's breaking his covenant and giving up on his people because they've rejected the shepherd. So it's really important to remember that there is no discrepancy between the Old Testament and the New Testament. There wasn't a plan of salvation in the Old Testament, and then it switched, and now there's a plan of salvation in the New Testament. There's not. This book, this from cover to cover, one story about Jesus and redemption through him alone. There's not a plan of redemption in the Old Testament, and then God said, "Wow, this is not working. I'm gonna switch and use Jesus as a secondary plan of redemption." There is one plan through the death and resurrection of Jesus, and the covenant in the Old Testament was pointing forward to the new covenant in Jesus. Jesus is the fulfillment of the entire law and the prophets. He fulfilled the old covenant. There is one plan of salvation for all mankind. And so, no, God hasn't broken his covenant. It is being fulfilled in Jesus. And even in our passage, in the darkness of chapter 11, there is hope that there was always a remnant. Those who were afflicted among the flock of Israel, who knew this is true, this is the word of the Lord, were holding out hope for the Messiah. And there were people in Jesus' day. You think about it, you get to Matthew, and I think you see people who were in the remnant. Elizabeth, Zechariah, Mary, Joseph, Anna in the temple. You have all these people who are just longing. We are holding out hope for the Messiah. There were always people who wanted that. And even in Jesus' day, there were people, they were small in number, but there were people who loved Jesus. After his resurrection and ascension, we're told there was 120 people who loved Jesus. And the gospel is preached on Pentecost, and there's 3,000 Jews that are saved. So even in our passage in chapter 10 of Jesus gathering in his people from all over, that still took place, and that is still taking place. God is bringing his people in, including Jews who trust in Jesus. God was faithful to his remnant. Even Paul mentions this in Romans 9:6. He says, but it is not as though the word of God has failed, because people were saying, well, the majority of Israel rejected Jesus. Does that mean that God has failed? And he says, no. It's not as if God has failed, for not all who are descended from Israel belong to Israel. He says there's a remnant. There is a group of people who always believed in the Messiah and his coming and what what he came to do. True believers and followers of the one true God. People among the flock who believed the word of the Lord. So lastly, how does this passage apply to us? I mean, besides the wonder of hundreds of years before Jesus came, Zechariah acting out in great detail the rejection of the Messiah, because we know even in the New Testament, in multiple places, Jesus is called our shepherd. John 10:14, Jesus says, "I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me." Like, if anyone was wondering, is Jesus the shepherd? He says, "I am the good shepherd." You don't have to wonder, it's me. Hebrews 13:20, it says, "Now may the God of peace, who brought again from the dead our Lord Jesus, the great shepherd of the sheep, by the blood of the eternal covenant." 1 Peter 5:4, "And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory." Revelation 7:17, "For the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd." So Jesus is our shepherd. And I know sometimes the tendency is we look at passages like Zechariah 10 and 11 and we think, or I know I do, sometimes I look and I go, how could the people in Jesus' day miss it? How on earth could they reject such a good and loving shepherd? I look back at in the Old Testament and I go, how could the people just keep sinning and sinning and sinning after God's been so faithful to them? How could they reject such a good shepherd? And yet we do the same thing all the time. We surrender to Jesus and we accept his gift of salvation. We trust in his death and resurrection, and he's our shepherd. He's meant to lead us, and we're meant to follow him. We're his sheep. We're called to obey him. And yet so often, I know, I rebel against him. I go, I don't like his leadership. Maybe I could actually do it better if I just did it my own way. Or as I'm being sanctified, my sinful flesh just still loves sin. So we look at what Jesus went through to redeem us, and he calls us to pick up our cross and follow him. He's the leader, not us. And yet, I know, and maybe I'm the only one, right? Like the song that we sang, prone to wander, Lord, I feel it, prone to leave the God I love. I do this all the time. It may be just in my thought life, maybe in my actions. I go, yep, Jesus is my shepherd, but I know I'm supposed to go this way, but I don't want to go that way. So I'm going to go this way. And we reject Jesus as our shepherd, and we need soft hearts so that we don't grow cold and heartless against him. Like, I can see it in myself, and in, you know, 15 years of church ministry, I have seen so many times people that you would never guess whose hearts grow cold against Jesus. So I want to encourage you, this is why we preach the gospel week after week after week. This is why you have to preach the gospel to yourself every day. I mean, like before your feet hit the floor out of bed, you have to go, who is Jesus? What has he done? What has he done for me? Who am I in light of that? What is God calling me to live like now? And maybe that's a minute every day, every morning. You just rehearse the gospel to yourself, because our sinful nature, it's so easy for us to just kick back against the leading of Jesus. I mean, we're just like the Israelites. We look back and we go, how could they have missed it? We're just like them. And we believe lies that maybe God's holding out on us, or maybe I know better rather than trusting and following him. So as we're in the Word and as we preach the gospel to ourselves, we have to ask the Holy Spirit, God, would you give us the gift of repentance? Help my heart not to grow hard against the gospel. Help me to have a soft heart that I can be receptive to Jesus, my shepherd's leading. And friends, thankfully, we have a God who is patient, and he is loving towards us. I mean, that picture, like I wander away and there's Jesus and he's whistling, right? And he's calling us back. And we're such stupid sheep. And we come back and then I wander away and he whistles and he brings me back. So thankfully, we're not left to ourselves. We have a good shepherd. And he whistles and he calls us back. Hopefully you're not offended that Jesus whistles at you. But he whistles and he calls you back, right? And he lovingly brings us back in. And I think our part is to pray, God, keep my heart soft so that I wander less.